This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio, produced today by Andrew Harris. This is John Williams. Thanks for dialing in. By the way, Steve Alexander, just a moment ago, you mentioned the Whiskey Acres. You were talking about the crop tours, which to me sounds like fun. They should get people in hay wagons and just pull them around Kendall and DeKalb counties and let us all go on a crop tour. I'm not kidding. I think that would be delightful.
I think that would be one way to do it, yeah.
And by the way, I can personally report on the quality of the crop at Whiskey Acres.
Yes.
The batch of bourbon I had was excellent to very excellent. So you said that is the only farm distillery or something?
The nation's only certified on-farm craft distillery is at Whiskey Acres in DeKalb.
Yeah, you'll see their product in your Binnie's and Jewel and wherever it is that you buy your spirits shelves. And he does make a good batch over there. It's 12-12. Okay, Elise Glink, you're not a bourbon drinker by any chance, are you?
I've sipped a little bit here and there. It's very nice.
Yeah, they do a nice job. Let's visit with Elise Glink. She is the real estate and personal finance expert. Visit thinkglink.com. Property taxes are out, correct? The second installment?
They are. Sorry, sad day for homeowners, right? Because we've got our property taxes due. There are about almost 2 million second installment property taxes that went out. Your payment is due October 1st, so you've got a few weeks to gather all your money together.
What's the latest on that? Up, down, good, bad?
You know, it's hard to say. I think that we've seen, you know, for people who protested their property taxes saying that, you know, property prices have been dropping, well, there's good news in that I think property prices are now zooming up. But there are some things available at the Cook County Treasurer.com website. So you can go to CookCountyTreasurer.com. Maria Pappas, obviously, is the treasurer. There are ways for you to pay online for free. There are ways that if you're running behind and your taxes are delinquent, what you can do about that. And there's some forms as well. So they're trying to make it as easy as they can. But there is an increase of 3.4% from last year. And the total that's been billed for 2020, because we in Cook County pay in arrears, that means we pay for last year, more than $16 billion.
Oh, we pay in arrears, all right. So up 3.4%. Wasn't there some delay? I don't know if I want to call it forbearance, but wasn't there some forgiveness last year?
There was a delay last year, not a forgiveness. The last time that there was a true, we're just not going to force anybody to pay any taxes, happened in Cook County somewhere in the 1930s because of the Depression. So they did have some, forgiveness is probably the wrong word, but delay in what was owed. And if you're having trouble making those payments, you certainly should reach out to the Cook County Treasurer's Office and see if there's a payment plan that they can put you on that would be affordable.
Can you talk at all about who's paying more and who's paying less? There was considerable disparity in the past.
And there still is. I think that if you look at the Pappas studies, so on the website, they talk about, she actually does this kind of study about who's paying more and who's paying less. And they look at commercial and industrial property owners. They're actually are now facing bigger tax bills than homeowners. So the total bill to business properties last year was more than $7 billion. That was an increase of a little over 6%. The amount billed to homeowners, $8.9 billion, and that was an increase of 1.3%. So comparatively, we're doing better than businesses.
Steve Bertrand on Chicago's Afternoon News was talking about the fact that her office has hired some former Chicago Tribune journalists to do the kind of deep dive they would do in an investigative piece and tell her a little bit more about who's paying, where's paying, how's paying, all of that. I thought that was maybe a good use of the resource of some of those smart fact diggers, right?
I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, really, real estate journalists, especially those who do investigative reporting, are trained to dig deep and find the things that are maybe not as palatable to everybody. One of the things that came out of the treasurer's report is that majority Black and Latino communities in Chicago make up 6 of the top 10 areas with the largest tax increases, and 7 of the top 10 increases for commercial properties. And so you wonder why would that be? But if you look at property increases and how much more properties are valuing, some of those communities had seen huge jumps in what the property values were. And so property taxes then follow along. But, you know, you always want to make sure you're being fair to everybody.
Mm. Looking at some of the increased values of homes, we'll pick it up here in just a minute. Elise Gleek joins us on WGN. 1219 on WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. And Elise Gleek joins us Mondays to start the week out, talking about the overall economic health of this country and you and real estate particularly. Although we really didn't talk about the markets and the economy overall, and the markets continue to set more records today, Amy. Amy Guth's coming up. Elise, the markets continue to do very well.
They do. We just got a notification from the National Association of Realtors. They looked at the second quarter of 2021. Get this, John, 94% of all metro areas saw a double-digit price growth in just the second quarter. I mean, the number is kind of insane. In Chicago, if you look year over year, the median home price right now in Chicago is $348,600. That's up 23% year over year.
$348,000. And that's up how much? 28% year over year?
It's up 23% year over year.
Yeah. Although it seems to me like the last few weeks we've been saying the peak is over. It's not as hot as it was. I guess that could be true because you're talking about second quarter here, right?
Yeah, this is looking backwards, right? So the second quarter ended in June 30th. July 1st started, you know, Q3. So we're about, a little better than halfway through Q3. But this is really sort of a remarkable thing. You know, when you look at the median sales price of existing homes, right, $357,000. We're a little bit under that here in Chicago. But 22% gain would have been a $66,000 valuation that it had gone up. And over 3 years, 46 markets had a price gain of over $100,000. There's a lot of value that homeowners are starting to recognize in their homes. Plus, there's still some value to be extracted for people who haven't refinanced yet. Mortgage interest rates this week are averaging below 3% for a 30-year fixed-rate loan. So
really,
getting out there helps people unlock even more money.
Over a three-year period, 46 markets had price gains of over $100,000. And that's not just on paper, I presume. Those were realized, or was that just the assessed valuation?
So the way that they do the median sales price, this is actual sales. So median is the midpoint, and it's the number of, you know, however many are above or below that midpoint are actually sold. So part of the reason this is going up is more higher priced homes are selling, and that's how the median price is rising.
Wonder if anybody is actually doing that thing where they say, well, now I'm going to take my extra $100,000 plus whatever equity I had, but now I got to give it to somebody else. I wonder if people are actually renting or moving into families' homes and waiting for the market to cool off and then coming out truly ahead. That's the theory, but that's such a pain in the butt. Nobody's doing that, right?
I think very few people are, but we are seeing, and what we did see, and I've seen it in my own neighborhood, John, and I'm sure you would as well, you know, there are a whole lot of people who were leaving downtown Chicago just like they do everywhere else, and they were looking for more space, bigger yards to accommodate little kids and lots of pets. And we see this push to the suburbs or to single-family houses from condo buildings. But what's really interesting is that we're now starting to see the condos sell as well. And what that tells me is that this pent-up demand is starting to actually push out in ways that are very, very normal. And the entire metro area of Chicago is seeing an increase.
Is the South and West in the United States doing better than the Midwest?
It is. They are, which is unfortunate. They don't have water down there. I wish people would understand that. But yes, in the South and in the West, they're seeing the highest prices. So I would say an outlier would be Pittsfield, Massachusetts. They were up, value was up 46% from a year ago. But Texas is big. Florida is big. Colorado has been huge. That's sort of more middle of the country, the Plains states and beginning into the Rockies. But Arizona's just been on fire. Las Vegas has done very well. So we're seeing just a tremendous number of properties in those areas just go up in value. And in fact, a lot of people who have lived in those areas for a long time, like in Boise, which has been on fire for the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, they can't afford to live there now. And they're moving out from Boise to smaller communities. They're pocketing their profits and buying out outlier properties.
Yeah, well, and that can happen. I mean, you know, I described the scenario where you make $100,000 additionally. There are places where it's less expensive to live, where property values haven't kept a pace. You have to be willing to go there. It has to be a feasibility for you, right? Not everybody can be mobile, but if you can, there is value to be captured out there.
Well, let me tell you about something going on in Peoria, which is...
I was just going to mention Peoria.
Yes. So there was a really interesting story in the Washington Post about how there were these online bidding wars for homes in Peoria. And Peoria has had tons of decaying homes. They've been having people leave, and they haven't had enough people. This is a little bit like the story of Detroit 12 years ago, when homes in Detroit were selling for literally $400 a piece or even free. And so in Peoria, these really, they're shambles. You can hardly even call them houses, but they were selling for as little as $700 to $1,400 a piece. And I do mean 1400.00. Yeah. Very cheap. And then those houses got flipped for $3,000 to $6,000, and now they've been flipped again. But they're still, I mean, in many cases, they don't have electricity and they don't have running water. They really are a shambles. But the idea that there are these houses in other places where you can actually go buy a house and spend the money actually fixing it up and have a place to live, that's something that's actually possible in places like Peoria.
Yeah, the majority of that stock in Peoria for $750 was bought online at an auction by one guy. And then he digitally flipped it, if you will, and didn't improve it. It's not like he was putting in new floors or roofs, and some of them don't have roofs.
Yeah. No, they're definitely sold in current condition.
Yeah,
like, we're not doing anything to it. But that said, there are other pieces of property in other cities, you know, around Chicago and other places around the country where, you know, if you've got the ability to work remote, you want to sell your house here and pocket the money, you can pocket up to $250,000. If you're single, up to $500,000. If you're married and filing jointly, according to the IRS, you can put that profit right into your pocket, not pay any tax on it, and go out to somewhere else and actually spend that money buying property.
I got family and friends in Peoria, so I paid attention to that Washington Post story and talked to my friend Greg down there about it. And he was well aware of the story. And I will say this. So any city has decayed neighborhoods where you might be able to do something like that. Peoria was a case in point. But there's also lovely homes in lovely neighborhoods that by Chicago standards are a lot of value there. There's a lot of value. And Peoria is a lovely town on the river. So it's kind of near and dear to my heart. And don't think that if you look a couple of hours south of Chicago, that's crazy. You could do a lot worse.
You can. And it's good to think about different places, right? I mean, Gary, Indiana is a place that had a lot of property that wasn't really properly maintained. It's a community that's really pulled together and trying to and has done a good job, I think, of building itself back. If you go north into the, you know, near the border of Wisconsin on the Illinois side or the Wisconsin side, there's lovely homes in smaller communities that are still available by, you know, train to Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. I think those who thought, well, you got to go Southwest Michigan. That's been Brendan and me forever. We just could never find anything that we thought was fair or good enough. And you know, we weren't looking for anything real expensive. It just seemed to be overvalued, overpriced is all I'm saying. And South Wisconsin, I thought, was maybe a better value. And I thought Peoria didn't look too bad either. And like I say, I got family and friends there, so maybe it's too close to my heart to be entirely objective, but that was where I was thinking.
You know, one of the things to keep in mind, and I think that here in Chicago in the metro area, we're pretty blessed that we have Lake Michigan, and we've got a really wonderful ongoing source of water. One of the issues that Peoria and some of the states that kind of go to the west from there are going to start to deal with is something that the Southwest is dealing with, which is this lack of water.
Yeah.
And Peoria is supposed to run out of water in about 9 years.
And I did not know that.
For the first time, there's an aquifer that's been fairly heavily tapped to provide all the corn and the other things we talk about here on the news. But something worth thinking about wherever you're moving in the country is, where is the water coming from? And over the next 10 to 20 years, is that water source stable? And it's just a question you should ask, because, boy, you're going to be sorry if you find out later that there isn't one.
ThinkLink.com. Elise Glink. Let's talk next Monday. Thanks, Elise.
You bet, John.
WGN Radio News is coming up. I can't make you 25.
Tune into the John Williams Show Wednesday morning at 11:35 to hear conversations with Carrie Peck. Carrie will be here to answer any questions you have on the process of will and estate planning. Peck Ritchie, winning solutions in and out of the courtroom.
Yeah, that Carrie Peck knows his stuff. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. John Williams here. Andrew Harris is producing today. And on Mondays, we frequently visit with Jim Dahlke. Today's no different. Jim, welcome again to the show.
Hey, John. Great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about your reporting at Chicago Inno. Let's start with this Northwestern accelerator that sounds like is going to benefit the faculty. Talk about that.
That's right. So just last week, Northwestern announced that it's going to create a new tech accelerator in Evanston, and that will grow the startups at the university led by the school's faculty. It's part of a $75 million investment, $50 million of which is coming from the state, and another $25 million from a Northwestern donor. And you know, really what it's looking to do is to kind of boost startups led by Northwestern faculty within health, life sciences, and other fields, kind of giving them access to lab space, management training, and other resources to really sort of tackle these big problems that are being incubated kind of within the university and help commercialize those and really provide them the equipment and the space they need to get these products off the ground.
Well, if a member of the faculty comes up with something, do they profit from it, or do they have to, as if you were working for GE or DuPont, then the company realizes the revenue? Who gets the money if somebody at Northwestern comes up with a good idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I certainly do believe that Northwestern is getting a piece of the action if this is a product created within the university. So there's certainly a benefit to Northwestern to kind of, you know, catalyze these projects and create a space for, you know, these university folks to kind of create businesses. You know, it's tricky, right? Because not all, you know, faculty are entrepreneurs necessarily by nature. I mean, these are academic folks. So I think what Northwestern is really looking to do is to kind of, you know, allow their entrepreneurial spirit to sort of grow a bit and sort of foster that with, you know, a more facilitated program here. So I think what you're going to see is some of the creations and some of the developments that kind of come out of these life sciences professors now be commercialized and turned into, you know, a real product for the market.
You could almost see that becoming a competitive way to recruit top-level faculty, as if, or, you know, researchers, scientists, whatever you produce will give you 8% and the other school gives you 12%, something like that.
That's right. And it's also a big boost for the students who will work on these projects as well, right? So you can imagine that it'll help the local economy, both in Evanston and in Chicago, as we create kind of these new high-tech jobs based off of this faculty work.
Esurance co-founder raises $33 million for insurance startup HDVI. Now, this is your story I'm reading here. Talk to me about high-definition vehicle insurance.
Yeah, so high-definition vehicle insurance, a relatively new insurance startup in Chicago, one of a handful of actually high-growth insurance startups that we're seeing pop up in the area. Just like you said, landed about $33 million last week. They're led by the co-founder of Esurance, Chuck Wallace. Wallace helped launch Esurance back in 1999. That company ultimately sold to Allstate in 2011 for around $1 billion. And what HDVI is working on is trucking insurance to kind of help the trucking fleets, you know, find more affordable insurance, kind of a cheaper alternative to some of the traditional folks, and also, you know, provide a suite of software tools to help trucking companies more easily manage their operations and actually reward trucking drivers for operating more safely. So kind of a suite of tech tools this company is operating, and an interesting business led by a seasoned insurance tech entrepreneur in Chuck Wallace.
There's a new travel app out of Chicago, right?
That's right. So last week we wrote about a company called Out of Office. And it is looking to help you better plan your next trip based on recommendations from your friends, people that you trust the most. I think anybody who goes to plan a trip right now does a quick Google search of, you know, the best restaurants to eat in X city, and you're kind of inundated with ads, essentially. You know, these are, you know, sort of sponsored content, you know, SEO tricks to get your business higher up in these search results. And kind of what Out of Office is looking to do is create a platform where you can get recommendations on the best places to stay and eat based on, you know, people that you trust. So it's an app for your friends, travel influencers, other people that you trust in terms of offering good travel advice. And just last week, they raised $1.6 million in new funding. Some of their investors include Cameo CEO Stephen Galanis and the former Orbitz chief product officer. So some money in and out of office so far from a handful of founders, actually, who previously worked at Trunk Club in Chicago.
Huh. So do you know how that works? Is it dependent upon everybody's participation? If my friends aren't saying where the good restaurants are in Denver, then I won't know. But if everybody plays along, then we sort of all help each other out with our recommendations. Is that it?
That's right. So the power of Out of Office definitely comes in the size of the users in the app. So they say by the end of their first year, they hope to be at about 100,000 folks. And so you think when you get to that level of scale, you're going to have some pretty interesting recommendations. So, you know, my thought is that this app will be both, you know, people that you know, but then also you're going to find travel folks and influencers and other people within the app who you just sort of respect their opinions on and kind of follow their advice as you want to travel into new cities. So they launched this app in the spring of 2020, which was certainly an interesting time to launch a travel app. But, you know, they, you know, really believed that, you know, the travel industry was going to bounce back. And I think that we're seeing that to some degree, even though the Delta variant and other variants are going to cause some issues in the travel industry. But, you know, they see a big boom coming in travel before too long.
Seems to me like that would work, though, wouldn't it? I mean, if it works for traffic in real time, everybody tell us where the good traffic is and the bad traffic is, and then we can all know where to go. Why wouldn't that work for restaurants or resorts, right?
Exactly. And, you know, in the age of traveling during COVID, you have to do a little more planning than ever before, right? You need to be a little bit more prepared as you enter a new city. And, you know, hearing from folks who've just been there and just done that, I think is certainly helpful as you're planning your trip.
Nice to talk to you again, Jim. Join us again next week, okay?
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke at Chicago Inno. The business news continues now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Abbott Labs, one of the leading producers of rapid COVID-19 tests, reportedly purged supplies and laid off workers as sales dwindled. Weeks later, as the U.S. faces a surge in infections, the suburban company is dealing with diminished capacity. Demand for the 15-minute antigen test, Binax Now, is soaring again as people return to schools and offices. The New York Times reports Abbott has told thousands of newly interested companies it cannot equip their testing programs in the near future. CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens have been selling out of the at-home version, and Amazon shows shipping delays of up to 3 weeks. Abbott is now working to hire back hundreds of workers. The U.S. has drafted United Airlines and other civilian carriers for the Afghanistan evacuee mission. The Pentagon has told airlines to provide a total of 18 planes to aid in the Afghanistan evacuation effort. The extra capacity will help military aircraft stay focused on operations in and out of Kabul Airport. In addition to United, American, and Delta have also been drafted by the military. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN Radio News from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom in 8.5 minutes. Let's talk to Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch about the Apple II computer. Not breaking news, but what is this, Amy?
No, certainly not breaking news. There is a manual for that Apple II computer that was signed by Steve Jobs, and it sold for just under $800,000. It sold for $787,484 at auction. Now, it is, you know, for many reasons, it's quite rare. Steve Jobs signed it. He wrote, "Julian, your generation is the first to grow up with computers. Go change the world." Steven Jobs, 1980. But also, it's a manual. Apple products don't come with manuals anymore, kind of by design. That's not really what they do. They're supposed to be like right out of the box. So it's this kind of collector's item. And this was sold by a Boston-based auction company. They're called RR Auction. This happened on Thursday. Kind of an interesting, you know, piece of history there from 1980, this manual of the Apple II computer.
Probably matters that it's, you're right, an instruction sheet or manual, that it's Jobs, because I don't think he signed many autographs either, right?
Right. Correct. Yep. That it's signed by him. And, you know, I mean, the Apple II, this manual was written in 1979, and it was all, you know, it was first written in, the product was first launched in 1977. This manual for the Apple II was 79. So, you know, it's been sitting for a minute, but of course made special that it was signed by Steve Jobs.
Boy, I wish I'd kept my first Apple product or my first computer or whatever, although it had a big tube and it was large and I don't suppose there's any value in some of those old things. But those, remember those Apple computers that kind of had a different colored shell on the outside and were kind of new wave and were kind of fun? There's probably a lot of those in people's attics and basements, though, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. You never know what kind of like old stuff will fetch at auction. My parents told me several years ago, oh, you know, you had your Atari and we threw it out. I thought, oh man, that could have fetched some dollars.
I know. Target is adding more than 100 Disney shops to its stores, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Ahead of the holiday shopping season, they're going to have these little kind of Disney pop-up shops inside of its stores. It'll be more than 160 of them by the end of the year. Now, a piece of that that we have learned later, just today, that came out kind of after this news about Target, was that Disney is going to close its Mag Mile store by mid-September. It will no longer operate any standalone stores in the Chicago area. So that's kind of part of this, that Target, these kind of pop-ups in Target. So that's what Disney and Target are both betting on to get them through that big retail shopping season.
Does this remind you of Toys R Us doing pop-ups, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're doing the same thing for Macy's. So, you know, and Ulta is doing this in some Target stores too. So I think this is going to be an interesting kind of subcategory of retail to keep an eye on, of where these big stores are kind of merging to have pop-up stores in these more general merchandise stores that fared really well during the pandemic, because people kind of felt like, here's, I can just go to one place and get all the things I need rather than going to five or six different stores. So I think that'll be an interesting kind of subcategory of retail to keep an eye on.
I know you also kept your eye on a wrinkle for travel in Europe. What's this story?
Yeah, so this has actually kind of been a few years in the making. So for now, Venice is set to introduce an entry fee and a special booking system for tourists. It's going to be like a turnstile, kind of like to go into, get on an L train. The fee reportedly will be between 3 and 10 euros. So US, that's about $3.50 to about $11.70, depending on the season. Now, if you are related to somebody in Venice, you don't have to pay that. If you have a child under 6 with you, they don't have to pay that. Or if you are staying in a local hotel, you will also be exempt from that. So these restrictions, these had been kind of talked about. They were originally going to be launched in 2019. Of course, the pandemic delayed that. And, you know, up to 80,000 people a day have kind of visited that city. And there have been protests from people saying, hey, we're getting priced out of living in our own city. Now it's more profitable to move outside of town and operate my home as an Airbnb. I can't even live in my own town. There's a lot of foot traffic. We've heard many issues caused by lots of cruise ships coming into the area. And in 2019, you know, one hit a Venetian dock and a tourist riverboat, you know, like all these things have kind of happened. So Amsterdam and Venice both have been having these conversations for a number of years about how do they fight over tourism. And both cities had been talking about taking this moment where there is no tourism, or at least very little, and reconfiguring it. So this is what Venice is going to do. It's going to start. It'll start by next summer.
I'm surprised the price isn't higher. I'm going to Amsterdam in about 6 weeks, and I thought, shoot, if you charged everybody on that cruise ship $25, we wouldn't notice it. $5 seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought too. I mean, given how much, you know, angst has been stirred up, there have been protests in both of those cities from locals, you know, talking about price and traffic and foot traffic and all the issues with tourism. And I think just with the popularity of both of those cities, I think a higher dollar probably wouldn't meet much protest from people visiting.
What are we talking about? Shut us up.
I know, right?
Why are we advertising for higher Fees for Americans. It's 12:57. That's Amy Guth. We'll visit later in the week. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN News from the Northwestern Medicine Newsrooms coming up.